Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
When you're trying to impress your grandson with your professional credentials,
I said, you know, Zachary, known as a nurse.
And even though he's three, he has assumptions about power structures in medicine.
He looked at me, he put both hands on his hips, and he said, my mother's a doctor.
Who should be the boss of it all? I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
Why are you asking me this battery of questions?
30 more seconds. I'm almost done. About 2 minutes more of drilling.
Because we don't know where you've come, and we don't know where you're going to go after this.
You know, it just sort of adds like a level of stress to something that's already stressful.
When we're looking for the needle in the haystack, the
just
high pathogenic
avian
influenza virus.
And every time I see that, I think, like, wow, that didn't exist before we made that happen.
On today's show, should scientists stop using racial categories in genetic research? A lesson in how to greet transgender people at a doctor's office? And who designed those cool space posters we've been seeing all over the internet? But first up, think about the last time you were in a hospital as a patient. Chances are you interacted with nurses much more than you did with physicians. Nurses are intimately involved with patient care. They walk the halls and they often spot big problems, for example, unnecessary alarms, years before anybody starts addressing them. We asked Pulse listeners who are also physicians to talk about their interactions with nurses, and here's what we heard back.
I can't even begin to stress how much I've learned from my nursing colleagues during the first few years of my training. Everything from how to place an IV to how I should present bad news to a family.
That was physician Josh Glick, and here's Russell Kaufman. As a med student, he was told by other physicians, when delivering babies, only use the stethoscope in one ear.
So that we could both hear the heartbeat of the baby, as well as hear the instructions of the nurse.
Listen to the nurses. They know what's up was basically the gist of many of the comments we received. Now, if we move from the patient rooms to the leadership suites, hospitals are facing different pressures these days. Some key goals are quality of care, cutting down readmission rates, and reducing hospital-borne infections. So does this change who should run the show? With the vast majority of hospitals, business or marketing types hold down the corner office. A very small fraction is run by physicians, but what about nurses? Does their ground-level experience with patient care make them good candidates for leadership? Tanya English set out to get answers.
Hey, Jen, how's it going?
Kelly Doyle is 5 foot nothing, but you can't miss her. Her laugh and her signature shoes echo down the halls. Doyle is CEO of Rothman Orthopedic Specialty Hospital. She's led the small for-profit in the Philadelphia suburbs since 2011. Once a week, she's in by 6 in the morning as the first surgeries of the day begin.
I've been known to wear heels in the operating room.
Doyle changes into comfortable blue scrubs to say hi to her surgeons, but she never kicks off the 4-inch suede pumps. As Doyle walks around the surgery suites, she's thinking about volume.
Mike, I didn't do a count today. How many cases do we have? At least how many?
20.
At least 20, okay. So we're doing spine and obviously shoulder, Dr.
Spine,
Laz here.
Shoulder and elbow and foot and ankle later.
Foot and ankle.
Once inside an operating room.
Right, so Dr. Lazarus is scrubbing his hands. Looks like he's getting ready to come in.
She's watching for habits that prevent medical errors.
One of the things that, as a nurse and a CEO, that I look to see that's hardwired is called the timeout process. And that's the last check before the incision.
Part of an executive's job is to make sure the hospital makes money. And that only happens, Doyle says, if people are getting quality care. Sports medicine surgeon Christopher Allen says he and other physicians trust an administrator just a little bit more if that person has experience working directly with patients.
The MBAs don't get it. You know, they've gone to school, they're brilliant, smart people, but they haven't been in the pits.
As CEO, Doyle gets two big report cards each month, patient satisfaction scores and the number of cases that come through the door. In her sales pitch, she talks about the free parking at Rothman and the guaranteed private rooms.
My job is to care about everything.
That includes meeting with her management team to figure out why the lights went out during the last big snowstorm.
Is it an easy fix to get them lighting on backup generator? I think we should do that. How much would it cost to run a store? Is it like something exorbitant?
Actually, we could probably do it.
They don't teach marketing and facilities management in nursing school. Christine Kovner should know. She's a professor at New York University's College of Nursing.
The CEO is doing things like figuring out, are we going to float a bond or not float a bond, or figuring out how do we recruit, you know, physicians from Mount Sinai so that we can be the center of dermatology rather than them being the center of dermatology.
Nursing students are so focused on clinical skills, Kovner says there's not much time for classes in leadership.
So the skills that you need to run a small business, it's a multi-million dollar business that has 50 employees, are not the same skills that you need to be able to react quickly in an emergency situation when someone suddenly starts bleeding.
There are nursing leadership programs around the country for mid-level managers, but registered nurses who go on to lead entire healthcare organizations often first return to school for a business or administration degree.
My name is Richard Webster, and I am the president of Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals.
He oversees thousands of workers and about 900 patient beds across three hospitals in Philadelphia. It's been a long time since Webster got his hands dirty, but he started his career as a staff nurse at the bedside.
You can't study that. You can't read that.
When Webster was first promoted into a job away from direct patient care, suddenly he was working with colleagues in marketing and finance to grow business inside the hospital.
To capture more market share, to focus on the patient experience.
When a doctor asks for a cool new piece of equipment, Webster weighs how much that toy might improve healthcare and how much it will cost.
And so you have the final say as president of the hospital about when that check gets written and when it doesn't get written.
For the most part, yes.
When you look up Richard Webster's bio, RN for registered nurse is the first of many letters listed after his name.
There are others that we have heard say, well, I don't want to put RN after my name because some people might not think that I know as much about business, or that that might be a detractor when I'm competing with others in the C-suite, especially men in the C-suite.
Pam Cipriano, who's president of the American Nurses Association, says that's disappointing. It also makes it hard to count up the number of nurses who are chief executive officers, chief operating officers, board chairs, and presidents. But anecdotally, Cipriano says she's noticing more nurses at the top.
We wish we had more data about how many nurses are moving into those executive positions.
It's pretty common for an RN to make the jump from staff nurse to manager, then eventually chief nursing officer. The next leap is more rare. At Rothman Orthopedics, I asked CEO Kelly Doyle why.
Sometimes when we say nurse CEO, we really are kind of saying women CEOs, but I'm not asking that. I'm asking, why do you think there aren't more nurses who are CEOs?
Women have to take a time out and raise their families.
Doyle says you can't overlook the fact that the vast majority of nurses are women.
If I had babies in my 30s, would I be sitting here? I don't know.
Then there's this.
Nurses aren't trained in finances. Nurses are trained in patients and patient care and patient safety.
A lot of what Doyle needs to know, she learned on the job. Soon after her promotion, she booked a two-hour lunch with a mentor.
And I took the financials with me, and I just asked him a lot of questions, and I tape recorded it, and I listened to that recording over and over and over again.
Today, she has an answer when a board member has a question.
Why is supply cost up? What's going on with supplies? What's happening with salary, wage, benefits? There's so many different factors that affect the bottom line.
There's a national movement to get more registered nurses appointed to all kinds of advisory boards. The goal is 10,000 RNs by 2020. Supporters say that change could make a significant difference to hospital leadership all around the country. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
listening to The Pulse. I'm Mikan Scott. NASA is quite the pop culture darling these days. The agency was featured prominently in the recent hit movie The Martian, starring Matt Damon.
Look, I mean, I don't mean to sound arrogant or anything, but I am the greatest botanist on this planet.
There were those killer Pluto pictures before that. And this past week, the vast corners of the internet were abuzz with some really cool-looking space posters put out by NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. 12 different posters in all advertise space travel to the tourists of the future. They're funny, they're whimsical, and they are insanely popular. Three of them were created by the Seattle-based design company Invisible Creature, and we're joined now by Don Clark. He's a graphic designer and the owner of that firm. Don, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Don, could you describe the three posters your company created for this series?
Sure. Yeah. The three posters are the Grand Tour, which became eventually the Voyager mission, and a few of the planets dropped out of the mission. But the Grand Tour, and then we created a poster for Mars, and then also for Enceladus, which was part of the Cassini mission for Saturn. And so it's those three posters, you know, very stylized, fun, whimsical takes on space travel.
It was hard to pick a favorite poster among these, but I tried. So right now I'm looking at the Mars poster. It says multiple tours are available. There's a lot of red in there. It has a retro look, a little bit trippy. What were you going for with that?
Well, we were commissioned by NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California, and so they actually gave us you know, the themes, the planets, the concepts, what they'd like to see. And so for Mars, kind of the big idea there was that, you know, we wanted that nostalgic travel poster charm, but almost in a way where we're looking 500 years in the future.
What were the rules you were given? Or were you given any rules?
We were given rules. It was great because there was that whimsy and that science fiction quality that they wanted to it, but they also wanted it to be rooted in science as well, what they do at Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So with us, you know, we're not scientists, we're artists, and so we're always kind of thinking, you know, grandiose, and, you know, who cares if we ever would have to do it? It just looks beautiful, you know, in real life. So they were more like, okay, well, no, this is what we've done, this is what we can do, and this is what we prepare to do, or what we're planning to do. And so we want the art rooted in real science, but this is where we think we're going.
So these things are going like hotcakes. It's actually right now hard to buy a printed copy. Did you expect them to be this popular?
Absolutely not. We usually do runs of like 100 to 200 posters, you know, when we do our own things. And so we had no idea. This art is actually available for free on JPL's website, NASA Jet Propulsion's website. You can download the art for free and print your own copies. But we also have limited edition prints that are, I think, almost out of stock at this point, that are, you know, hand signed by the artist on nice paper that we sold. So yeah, we were not prepared for this at all. And it really does show that people are interested in NASA and, you know, good art. So that was really exciting.
And it seems like NASA is really trying to rebrand itself as a very hip organization. Did you get that sense working with them?
A little bit. I think that, you know, we worked with a really small team at JPL. And so I think that that is kind of what's happening, but that was never, you know, that was never talked about. You know, I had just watched The Martian, and Jet Propulsion Laboratory plays a large role in that film, and it's an exciting one. And so, yeah, the whole thing was exciting, and honestly, I hope it leads to more.
How did this all come about? How did you get this assignment?
Well, it's interesting. My friend works at JPL, and we used to play music together, and we would, in different bands, but we would come across each other on tour, and he had gotten a job at JPL and asked if we wanted to do it, which was quite amazing given our family history. My grandfather actually worked at NASA as an illustrator for over 30 years at the Ames Research Center and actually illustrated the Pioneer plaque, the very first illustration to go into space. Should extraterrestrial life find the ship, it had a nude male and female illustration on there, also where Earth sits in the solar system. So it was really cool to get this project, have this thing kind of come full circle for our family.
Don, thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. It was an honor.
Don Clark is the owner of Invisible Creature, a design firm based in Seattle. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mikan Scott. For 2,000 years, cities have been trying to get sewer systems right, ship out the bad stuff and pipe in fresh water. Researchers are trying to improve one aspect of this process right now, and they're working with an unlikely suspect, pond scum. Here's Todd Bookman.
To understand the drawbacks of modern wastewater treatment, you've got to understand the process. And so let's start with the first step.
You flush the toilet. Then what happens?
So there's typically a collection system. So all our pipes go into a sewer system. And all of that wastewater that we're putting down our drains and flushing down our toilet ends up at different wastewater treatment plants.
This, by the way, is Christopher Solis.
I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering at Drexel University.
Solis, along with his graduate assistant Jake Price, spend their days thinking about wastewater, what to do with it after it arrives at the treatment plant.
Wastewater enters the wastewater treatment plant, and it goes through a couple of different bar screens to remove large solid objects, and then it goes into a large settling tank in which the fats and the lipids and all of the less dense material will float to the top, and it's skimmed off the top.
So the chunks have been screened out, the top skimmed off. Now it's time to tackle the dissolved, murky stuff.
Yeah, the second step, we often call it in the wastewater treatment world the activated sludge process.
Activated sludge is a poorly branded but very valuable brownish substance. It is teeming with good bacteria. And sort of like how you harvest sourdough starter, sludge comes from previously aerated wastewater. When added to the new wastewater, it thrives off of the oxygen being bubbled into the tanks and eats up the diluted organic waste. It then clumps together and settles to the bottom, where it can be filtered out and used again. After the sludge process, the wastewater is actually pretty clean. Still not quite potable, but in many parts of the country, they call it good. Maybe add a little chlorine, then discharge it into rivers or lakes. The entire process kind of works.
It works okay, but we're finding that that these wastewater treatment plants don't remove enough nitrogen.
Nitrogen from us, from our waste, which is still in high concentrations in the discharge, what's called the effluent. If you've ever read the back of a bag of fertilizer, you know nitrogen is a good thing in the right doses. Plants love it. But in the rivers and lakes that receive wastewater, algae like it too much. It causes massive algal blooms. They go crazy on this stuff. But then the nitrogen runs out and the algae dies off.
The cells die. And when the cells die, they're grazed upon by other microorganisms. And those microorganisms tend to consume a very large amount of oxygen.
And when they do that, they consume up all the oxygen in the water, and we create these dead zones, or hypoxic zones, in rivers where fish can't survive.
And that's bad news for the entire ecosystem.
Very bad.
Right now, some facilities around the country do take extra steps to pull out nitrogen from the effluent. But it's a time-consuming process that requires extra ingredients, plus a good deal of energy and space, which means it costs a good deal of money. Solis and Price and a few collaborators are working on an alternative solution. And curiously, it uses that same algae that in the natural environment causes so much trouble. Inside a windowless laboratory, Solis shows off a graduated cylinder, The bottom half thick with pea soup-like algae.
And it's greenish in color, and there's a kind of a greenish zone on the bottom of it where there's algae, actually a mixture of algae and bacteria.
The roughly foot-and-a-half tall cylinder is connected to a series of tubes and pumps, which slowly circulate aerated wastewater.
Each droplet of water that goes into our reactor from that's wastewater spends at least 8 hours in the reactor system.
During that 8 hours, the clump of algae and bacteria suck up the nitrogen, thrives off of it. The water is basically getting filtered by this living community of microorganisms, eventually leaving the wastewater safer for discharge.
Well, the water that comes out of here doesn't have a zero concentration of those nitrogen species, but it's significantly lower than what was in the wastewater.
Under the right conditions, the algae pulls out up to 80% of the nitrogen. The other good result is that the nutrient-dense algae is itself valuable. In theory, it can be processed and turned into biofuels or fertilizer. Scientists have been experimenting with algae's ability to cleanse water for something like 50 years. This team of scientists, though, is using modern genome scanning tools to figure out which players inside the algae bacteria world are most active in the process.
So we're not just imagining these as black boxes, but we're starting to look at the microbial processes, the enzymatic reactions, who's there, who are the players in this whole kind of mixture, this green sludge that's in these reactors.
Jake Price says they're trying to build a better algae by simply harnessing what's already in the world.
The idea of relying on microbes and on Mother Nature's millions and billions of years of evolution to clean up humans' messes is a very elegant solution.
Still, this solution only works at lab scale. Best case, Solis and Price say it could take a decade before they've engineered a system big enough to actually work at a wastewater treatment facility. Until then, flush gently, folks. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Caucasian, African American, Hispanic. We're often asked to check these boxes when we're applying for a job, answering census questions, or when we're participating in research studies. A new paper published in the journal Science urges researchers to stop using racial categories in studying human genetics. The authors argue that these categories are not well supported by biological evidence and that they are not useful in medicine. I talked with two authors of this paper this week, Dorothy Roberts of the University of Pennsylvania Law School and Michael Udell of the School of Public Health at Drexel University. And I first asked Dorothy how clinical research which uses racial categories affects patient outcomes.
Well, doctors have for a long time, actually since the slavery era, assumed that patients of different races have different diseases and experience common diseases differently. And that simply isn't true. Human genetic diversity isn't broken down into biologically discrete races. And when doctors practice that way, they tend to allow these divisions of race to overwhelm even the individual clinical indicators. So, for example, because of the myth that sickle cell is a black disease or cystic fibrosis is a white disease, white patients may be underdiagnosed for sickle cell and other hemoglobin diseases, and black patients have been underdiagnosed for cystic fibrosis. It simply isn't the case that diseases break down into these social categories of race. And when doctors assume that race is biological rather than social, they can make these mistakes.
If I sign up to participate in a research study, who gets to put down what race I am? And how is that even decided?
Well, that depends. And that's one of the inconsistencies we point out in our paper, that sometimes people will self-identify based on how they understand their ancestry, and other times the heads of research projects will assign a racial category to an individual. The same thing happens clinically, which is one of the challenges, and that's sort of the slipperiness of the race concept.
And Dorothy, how many race categories are there right now, and who came up with them? How are they used?
That's a great question, because the way in which scientists are using race by and large, and doctors use race, is referring to what is the current census categories, which are clearly social categories. Historically, there have been many different definitions of race. They also differ around the world. And so it seems very odd that scientists would use a category as a scientific term that is so fraught with confusion and ambiguity and inconsistency. There's no absolute scientifically based, you know, genetically determined definite number of races.
And genetically, we're more alike than we are different along those lines.
Yes, and the Human Genome Project showed us that. And what was interesting for us as scholars who have been following this for almost two decades now is that in the wake of the Genome Project, you had scientists like Craig Venter and Francis Collins who called for us to move away from using racial categories, yet here we are, you know, 15 years later still utilizing those. I would also add that embedded in scientific thought about race and human genetic diversity is this paradox that on the one hand, scientists, geneticists do recognize that race is a poor proxy for measuring difference between groups, but on the other hand, they say that it's the best proxy we have. And that contradiction, that paradox, has really been with science since the 1930s, 1940s, when evolutionary biologists and population genetics sort of reimagined what race meant. And for them, race was simply a methodological tool to organize human groups. But as we know, all too often, the social ideas about race have come back and reintegrated themselves into scientific thinking about race.
How could the concept of race be replaced in research? What could be used in its stead?
In our paper, we talk about the concept of ancestry, which we believe is a concept better suited to understanding human genetic diversity. We recognize that there are risks that by simply substituting one concept for another, given the broader understanding of human difference that has haunted our society for centuries, that it may not work out, but we hope to at least make a very strong effort in this area.
We often read studies that say something like African Americans are more likely to have undiagnosed heart disease. I'm kind of making these examples up. Or African Americans are more likely to suffer with diabetes and so on and so forth.
Yes.
And what do we as readers take away from that, and what does it mean or not mean?
I think what we should take away from it is that there are glaring and horrible health inequities in our country because structural inequality does produce different outcomes in health. When scientists use race as if it were a biological category in research, it sends the message to the public that we're talking about innate differences and that these differences in health are caused by genetic difference. But the inequities in health that we see are caused by social determinants, social inequalities in healthcare, in neighborhood conditions that lead to these glaring differences in health that we do need to address, but not by fixing people's genes, but by addressing the social inequality that produces them.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dorothy Roberts from the University of Pennsylvania Law School and Michael Udell of Drexel University's School of Public Health talking about their paper on the use of racial categories in genetic research. For our next segment, we head back to the hospital. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and nearly one-third of new physicians or those still in training have symptoms of depression, according to new research. Those rates are much higher than the rates in the general population. Pulse contributor Netta Freya reports.
It's late afternoon at a busy medical clinic in Baltimore. Dr. John Allen sits at a small desk by the window. Pale yellow sunlight streams in, a can of diet soda rests on the windowsill. He scrolls through his patient's test results on his computer screen and picks up the phone.
This is Dr. Allen. Just want to go over the results of your recent hand x-ray, let you know the good news. There's nothing broken. If you have any questions, please call me back.
John is in the second year of his internal medicine residency at the University of Maryland. He remembers his first year out of medical school. His intern year was terrifying.
It's extremely intimidating for someone to look at you and say, Dr. Allen or Dr. Such and Such, and you are their provider. They don't realize that this may be your first day on the job and that you are not sure yourself that you're their doctor.
This feeling of being an imposter is common for a new physician. After 4 years of medical school, intern year is the first time a doctor is actually on the job. As John gained experience, he took care of a patient who affected him deeply.
There was a very young gentleman who had metastatic cancer that encased his lungs. And on the day that he ended up dying, I was at bedside with him and his nurse and his father for probably 5 or 6 hours and made sure he was comfortable. And I think he died a peaceful and comfortable death, but at the same time, watching a dad who was in his 40s lose a teenage son to something I was powerless to stop, it was very humbling. Because I think that you learn a lesson when you see something like that, that despite all the years of training, you obviously cannot fix what's happening.
There was another time when John tried to save a patient's life in the ICU. He was covered in the patient's blood, doing chest compressions for almost half an hour. When the patient died, John went to break the news to his sister.
She thanked me for trying so hard to save her brother's life. And I remember just feeling at that time like a huge failure and not feeling like I deserved any thanks or any praise for my efforts because they had not succeeded and he had died and he was a very young man.
Experiences like these took a toll on John.
There was a lot of my intern year where, not realizing it at the time, where I think I was actually in like a major depression legitimately.
John is not alone. According to a recent study in the journal JAMA, one out of every three physicians in training experiences depression. This is about 3 times higher than in the general population. And the consequences are serious, including a higher rate of suicide in doctors. So why?
I think there's a variety of reasons.
That's Dr. Janet Serwent, the vice chair of pediatric education at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. She's in charge of training the hospital's newest pediatricians fresh out of medical school.
I think there's a lot of perfectionism in medicine. And so I think there sometimes can be self-blame when there's an outcome that perhaps you weren't really responsible for. You don't in medicine probably have very much control over some of your schedules, some of the events that happen.
When these pressures collide, it's easy for new doctors to struggle and to feel like they're alone, especially if the culture is to keep pushing forward and not talk about it.
You know, it used to be really endorsed that if you were ill, you came to work and you were rounding with an IV in your arm as you're getting IV hydration. I think and hope that those days are over.
It has been a slow and steady shift away from those days. The JAMA study analyzed data from over 17,000 residents in different fields dating back to the 1970s. It found that depression rates increased steadily as time passed. Imagine a graph with a line that's creeping upward, getting a little bit higher every year. This line and the awareness that the line even exists may be driving some of the change. A focus on duty hours also plays a role here and has been studied this year at over 100 residency programs around the country. How many hours in a row can or should a new physician work? What's the right balance between learning as much as possible and being well rested?
A lot of the reasons why I had those symptoms is strongly related to the sleep deprivation and feeling very, very tired.
Dr. Sandra Quezada remembers the fatigue. She's a gastroenterologist and assistant dean at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Now that she's finished all of her training, she feels like herself again. But when she was a resident, she had little energy. She lost interest in activities she used to love. She just felt like someone different.
And I learned a lot about myself during that time, mainly that by nature, I am a happy, positive person. And I really lost touch with that in residency. And I do think that a lot of that had to do with just being exhausted.
So Sandra did what many other young doctors do. She gave herself pep talks to get through the difficult times.
I remember having to tell myself things in order to feel better and get through. So like telling yourself like it's going to get better, like next year will be better or next month will be better. And you have to keep telling yourself. And sometimes it really wasn't, but you just kept telling yourself that.
Even outside of the duty hour debate, educators like Janet Serwent want to usher in a more compassionate era of medical training. She's part of a national group that's studying this and polling residents on what they need to feel well.
First of all, I think everyone should develop their own wellness learning plan. So say you're involved with a really difficult situation, how do you get through that situation and then handle it afterwards? Some people maybe need to go vent to their spouse or a colleague.
Some may need coping strategies like mindfulness, meditation, or exercise. There are system-wide changes too, things that hospitals can do.
Making sure there's a supportive environment at work, not having a stigma about reaching out for medical health issues.
Janet's residents created a wellness committee to improve the learning environment, from supportive debrief sessions when a patient doesn't do well to simply making sure workspaces are bright and functional. If a resident is already struggling with depression, there is help available. Hospitals have employee assistance programs, which used to focus more on physicians with debilitating illness like drug and alcohol addiction. But now they're offering counseling and treatment for doctors in even the earliest stages of depression.
We can get people into resources very quickly. It is so important to reach out and, again, not suffer in silence or in isolation.
Tell me, how are you doing now?
I'm doing a lot better now. I've learned a lot of coping skills and a lot of ways to sort of center myself and be more the person I want to be.
John did many of the things Janet recommends. He opened up to family, his fiance, his friends and mentors. He reached out for help. And with educators like Janet leading the way, more physicians like John can take care of themselves so they can take care of their patients. For The Pulse, I'm Netta Freja.
Pulse contributor Netta Freja is an internist at the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. In the past year, several transgender-specific health clinics have opened across the country, including the first trans VA center in Cleveland, Ohio. General medical practices are also trying to meet the needs of these patients better, and there's a learning curve for everybody in the office. Most physicians get some training in medical school on how to talk to and about transgender patients, but what about the staff on the front line, the receptionists, the nurses, or medical assistants? Paige Flager reports.
Okay. So these are the things we're going to talk about today, just to give you sort of an overview.
Katie Margot is standing in the front of a conference room, getting ready to give a lecture. She's an associate professor of family medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, but she's not teaching med students today. Her audience is the non-physician staff of her medical practice. They're mostly women wearing jewel-toned scrubs, and just like students in lecture halls, they all sit towards the back. Margot is starting them off with the basics, vocabulary.
Sexual orientation, I imagine you guys know what sexual orientation is. It's a little more complicated than you might have thought about before.
She's breaking these things down because her practice at Penn Family Care is marketing itself as an LGBT-friendly health center. Today, she's talking specifically about how to take care of transgender patients.
Sometimes you're going to call somebody's name that says Fred so-and-so, and up will pop a woman. And it's confusing to you. Has anybody had that happen?
Some of the staff nod.
Yeah. So what do you do?
She invited along one of her patients, Junior Brainerd, a transgender man, and his partner, Tina Montgomery, a transgender woman. Montgomery chimes in, suggesting that instead of using first names, the staff should just say the first initial and the last name of the patient.
And then when they stand up, it's not good to call them out in front of everyone to say, "You are Fred Jones." Didn't help. Just say F. Jones, and that's it. Try not to stare once they get up.
Margot knows how confusing these situations can be. Back in the early 2000s, she had a transgender man come to her clinic who told her that she could do better with trans patients. He wanted Margot to prescribe him hormones, which is something that she does routinely today. But at the time, she didn't know anything about it.
He said, "Well, you really need to go to this conference and you really need to look at this and stuff online." And I did, and it was incredibly helpful.
Now she wants everyone that she works with to be sensitive to this particular patient population. Many East Coast cities have health centers that specialize in LGBT care. But as of recently, these centers have more patients than they can take care of, says Jamison Green. He's the president of the World Professional Association of Transgender Health.
There's been a growing trend of transgender people being able to connect with other transgender people, realize they're not alone, and feel empowered to ask for services that everyone else receives.
He says that this uptick in demand is happening all over the country. And in Philadelphia, Katie Margot is seeing a lot of those patients.
They seek out a number of things. First and foremost is equal and compassionate care, sensitive to their particular situation. That's an important starting place.
But that equal and compassionate care can be hard to get for someone who's transgender. A national survey conducted by advocacy groups found that out of 6,000 transgender and gender nonconforming individuals, about half reported avoiding medical attention when they're sick out of fear of discrimination. Junior Brainerd and Tina Montgomery say they've experienced discrimination firsthand, which is part of the reason why they're here today. Here's Brainerd.
We had a very negative experience. This was about 5 years ago at the Penn Fertility Clinic that basically ended in they refused to work with us and told us that we would never conceive a biological child.
Their plan was for Brainerd to carry and give birth to the baby as a transgender man. And as evidenced by baby Tony sitting on his lap and drinking a bottle, Brainerd and Montgomery could, in fact, conceive a biological child. Sometimes for transgender patients, their experience at the doctor's office can be ruined before they even see the doctor. Here's Jamison Green again.
Well, often one of the barriers that trans people experience is the first person that they encounter at the clinic. If that person says, "We don't treat people like you here," they leave.
He says that bad experiences in medical settings are especially problematic for transgender patients because of what's at stake. The trans community has high rates of substance abuse, HIV, and mental health issues, including depression, anxiety, and suicide.
Part of the reason that those disparities have occurred is the stigma and the bias that prevents people from getting the care that they need.
Making the doctor's office feel safe and welcoming could mean the difference between catching those things early on or being too late. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
If you recognize Junior Brainerd and Tina Montgomery's voices, it's because they were on our show last week to talk in depth about their journey to conceive a child. You can find that story on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. When a major illness takes hold of our lives, it's often the little joys that we miss most. For Diego Luke, it was hockey. Diego grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, where local leagues abound, and since preschool, he'd played competitively. In the summer of 2010, he was looking forward to making the step from the Squirt League to the Pee Wees. But on August 28th of that year, his 12th birthday, his hockey career came to an unexpected halt. He'd had a terrible headache, so his parents took him to their local clinic, where a nurse said, "Get him to the ER." In this edition of our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping, we accompany Diego on the five-year journey that began with that ER visit.
I just remember them bringing me back because my blood pressure was so high, and they just couldn't believe it. "We need to hospitalize him for the night." Yeah, from there we kind of knew that things were going to change.
"Dixie, come here. Come here, Dixie. Come here."
This is me and my dog, Winn-Dixie, a couple weeks after I got out of the hospital. My dad was recording us. You should know my parents record everything, as you'll hear.
"Say hi."
I had stage 3 kidney disease. I didn't know what that meant, but I did know I couldn't eat my favorite foods anymore. Because I was on a low-salt diet, you know, that actually made me cry.
"So what do you hope for this year?"
"I hope that they can figure out what's going on with my kidneys so I can start to have more salt. Oh, and you know what I want for my birthday? a bacon cake.
When I first started dialysis, it was nice.
There it goes.
It was a really big TV, and there was a recliner in there. They had, like, heated blankets. After, like, the third and fourth month, it just gets devastating. I mean, you're doing it 3 times a week, 4 hours each time, and then I would cramp up terribly. Every muscle in your body is cramping because it doesn't have enough liquid, and you can't move. And I'm screaming at them, I'm swearing, I'm begging them to take me off and for it to just be over. But it's like they can't, because that's that machine, that's the only thing that's keeping you alive.
Tomorrow at 9 I have to do what we call the day minus one visit.
My kidney doctor came to dialysis 2 days before my transplant. Someone from my mom's work had stepped up to give me one of her kidneys. It was really hard to find me a match. This donor saved my life.
See, you can get a lot out of this kidney.
I remember the day of the transplant. I'm just kind of groggy. There's all these machines and IVs and nurses in and out. And then it's over. You know, that's what I thought. It's done. I beat it.
Blood pressure time. Very nice.
I got transplanted on August 1st, 2012. The year after that was just bad. I think it was because I lost hockey, and I was just really mad about that. Then about 8 months after the transplant, my right neck, you know, like, itched, so I was, like, itching it, and I felt this lump there. That wasn't there yesterday. So it literally got there overnight. I remember that. Like, it was just like, whoop. They did a biopsy of it. I mean, my dad placed a bet. I was like, I bet you it's cancer. He's like, nah, it's not cancer.
So basically what the lymph node pathology shows is that, that unfortunately Diego has lymphoma. Called it.
I went on 6 months of chemotherapy, and I gained 70 pounds. I just couldn't stop eating. The steroids were bad for me. And, you know, I still haven't lost that weight. But, you know, I haven't lost my will to try and work it off either.
Got my skates. And then my socks.
This is me last week getting ready for hockey practice. After 5 long years, I can play again.
1, 2, 3, Coolers!
When I'm out on the ice, I feel great. I don't feel like I've been on life support before. I don't feel like I'm sick. I mean, I'm out of breath, I'm out of shape, but I can still compete.
Way to be in position, Diego.
And it's the only thing that makes me feel normal and like I was when I was a kid. And that's the kind of fight I like.
Diego's story was recorded and produced by his mom, Lori Stern. She tells us that recent scans show no trace of cancer and that Diego's new kidney is working fine. He's a junior in high school now, which means he'll probably get to play varsity hockey next year. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Libby Tracy is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Joel Patterson, the managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Next week, we're going to look at addiction and the evolving war on drugs. And for that show, we're doing a piece about anti-drug messaging. What are the slogans you remember the most from your teen years?
Who taught you to do this? And the kid says, you, all right? I learned it by watching you.
Pretty vivid memory there. So what stuck in your head, and what did you think about it? Tape your recollections using the voice memo function on your smartphone and send them to us at thepulse@whyy.org. Or if you need help with taping yourself, just send us an email. To make sure you don't miss that episode of The Pulse, subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.